Hello, Joel here. I've got a new book out. It's called Be Funny or Die: How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. And it's about how comedy works and why it matters. Why human beings tell jokes, and then what that tells us about being human beings. So if you're a human being and you enjoy laughing and then want to know what the hell's going on with that, it's probably a pretty good book to read. It's called Be Funny or Die. It's in shops. You can buy it.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And welcome to Rule of Three, a podcast about comedy. I'm Joel Morris.
I'm Jason Hazley.
And as usual, we are joined by someone who makes comedy to talk about something funny that they love. And by taking it apart, maybe we'll learn something about how comedy works, or we'll just quote bits from it and giggle until we're finished. Both approaches are valid. Our special guest today is Davy Jones. Davy is a cartoonist and writer, most famous for doing the bits of Viz that are a bit mental. He's responsible for Gilbert Ratchet, Major Misunderstanding, Roger Irrelevant, and the Vibrating Bum-Faced Goats, amongst millions of other strips. But Davy has joined us to talk on the radio about drawings.
Hello.
I think it's a good
Hi.
One. This is going to work. This is going to be fine. It's going to be fine. Drawings on the radio. This is like educating Archie. This is the ventriloquism on the radio works.
Yes,
we can do...
Dancing about architecture.
We can do cartooning on a podcast. This is possible.
Yes, so, describing drawings, it's going to work really well.
It's going to be a bit like when my history teacher used to come in and talk every morning about the cartoons that had been in the Telegraph that day. And he'd describe the cartoon and kill it. It'll be like that.
Question one. Davy Jones, the Vibrating Bum-Faced Goats, please explain.
Explain?
How did you get there?
I spent the whole day reading old Sparky annuals. Because there was a particular kind of comic strip that they'd do in these old DC Thompson annuals, which was that kind of comic strip. Mm. You know, the kids would have... There'd be some very wholesome kids who lived with an uncle, and they'd have something that would be the point of the strip. There was somebody who was called something like Little Jimmy Jonah, and he lived in a whale carcass on a beach, which was quite a nice idea, but... didn't really go anywhere, as you can imagine. This is the sort of thing you'd get in the Dandy in the 1960s. And I was very keen on these strips, so I thought I'd do one or two myself.
They always astonish me, those, where as a writer you look at them and you go, I could imagine getting one strip out of the idea of a boy who lives in a whale carcass. Mm. And these things would run for like 8 years.
Yeah, they did well. the ones that were more successful than that were... General Jumbo, which you might remember from, was it the Beano, I think? And he had a remote-controlled army of clockwork soldiers that had been invented by his, you know, brilliant uncle or something. I really liked the way these things were written, so I thought I'd have a go. And I remember it was when I lived in Maris. I was freelancing for Viz then, and I'd spent the whole day going through old annuals trying to get an idea. I wanted to do something about goats, and then you get to the point of the day, and I gave up, and I thought, I'll go to the pub. It's about tea time. And I used to have this rule where any idea you had within the first half pint that you drank would be okay. And anything after that, wouldn't you bother thinking of anything after half a pint. So, but I thought of it within the first half pint.
It's the optimum creative.
Yeah, point. Yeah.
I should mark the pint halfway down. Just don't bother.
Well, I sort of almost did. Yeah, I mean that's what I used to do. But it's also a rule that worked because you know you're not going to waste the whole night thinking of stupid ideas.
Yeah, you can relax then.
You can relax, yeah. Because that's the rule. You can't break the rule, the half-pint rule.
So. We've had the same experience as a lot of writers have when you do rooms, when you're actually sitting there writing from 10 till 6. Mm. At 4 o'clock, everybody's energy levels crash.
Yeah.
And nobody says anything for about an hour. And between 4 and 5, no work is done. It's just not possible. What really you should do then is go and have that first half-pint.
Mm.
But because you're being paid to be there, people feel an obligation to be there, like being Japanese middle managers. They won't go until the boss leaves, you know. So you sit there, and then at 5 o'clock, people go mad. And for 1 hour, between five and whenever someone calls time on it, you just get the most bizarre, ridiculous, usually dreadful ideas.
Yeah.
But it's just everyone's brain having one last violent scream before, you know, heading for that before first half point where you'll have the better ideas.
Yeah. Yes, that's it. It's like being in the Arctic when you take all your clothes off. That's the last thing you do before you die,
yeah.
Isn't it? When you've got hypothermia.
A frenzied act of a madman.
I mean, you're not going to get it just by having a half pint. You need a day of thinking first.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah, you can see it all clearly then.
Then you can get something as good as the vibrating bum-faced goat. I remember coming out to visit the Viz. The first time we came to visit the Viz office, one of the most amazing things was there was a ride-on 20p in the slot.
Oh, yes.
Mechanical, yeah. Vibrating bum-faced goat. And it was the idea of something that stupid having become real.
It had been built for an exhibition, and it had been built by Steve Donald, the oldest of the Donald brothers. And he was a brilliant engineer and everything. I mean, he worked for films. He'd built this. It was like a children's ride of a vibrating bum-faced goat. He'd built it to look like it had exploded. In the exhibition, there was a sort of police tape around the outside of it, and the chalk outline of a child on the floor. It was something that had gone terribly wrong. And there were a few puzzled people at the exhibition. Oh my God, what's happened here?
You know its whereabouts now.
I'm not sure. I haven't got it. It might have.
Why haven't you got it? You should have it.
You're entitled to own it.
I don't think it got thrown out. Or it might have got thrown out.
I think we should find out where it is. Have half a pint and plan a heist. A really good heist.
It'll be in someone's shed. I should imagine.
We are going to talk about comics. We're going to talk very much about the kind of comics that inspired Vibrating Bum-Faced Goats, because I think that the thing you've agreed to bring in for us today is probably one of the most inspirational comics of all time. What have you brought to show us?
I've brought in the Willy the Kid books by Leo Baxendale. Oh,
just so happy you recommended it.
How did you come by them, Joel? Because you're a bit younger than me, and they came out sort of 76, 77.
Yeah, they're sort of punk contemporaries, aren't they?
Yeah.
Leo Baxendale, I knew about the he's the guy who created the Bash Street Kids.
Mm.
Probably the most famous thing he did for the Beano. So I knew about them, and I knew I liked the Bash Street. I wasn't a huge Beano fan, actually. I liked the Bash Street Kids more than the rest of the Beano. I used to get the Bash Street Kids annual for Christmas and not the Beano book. Because
right.
They were my favourite bit. Mm. And I went round a friend's house, my friend Ross from school, who had stuff I didn't have. He had Big Track. And he had a loft he could play in, stuff that was beyond the dreams of me. And he had this, I think he had Willy the Kid book one or two. And I went round and he said, you should look at this. And all I remember is going round, looking at this book and not being able to breathe for laughing. I don't think, there's been a few times in my life I've laughed as hard as when I first saw Willy the Kid, but I thought I would die. And I walked home and I couldn't get the images and the jokes out of my brain. I would have been about seven or eight. And I walked home and I just couldn't stop laughing. I think it was his book, or it belonged to a brother or a cousin or something, and he'd inherited it.
Mm.
And it was our secret. And no one else I knew had ever seen it.
Mm. The surprise of them was because when you'd read comics, you didn't really expect to laugh, I don't think. The guy who did Wallace and Gromit, Nick Park, he was saying that he always read comics as a child, but he never remembered laughing at them. It's something you read with a completely solemn face.
They were meant to be entertaining and to stop you being bored.
Possibly, but you could be quite absorbed by them. I was always absorbed by the Beano and comics like that, and I'd read them, but I wouldn't often laugh.
Yeah, but yeah, I think it was a revelation. I think I'd read Whizzer and Chips and Buster and the Beano, and I'd enjoyed them enough to keep buying them.
Mm.
It's odd to find out the power of a joke to properly make you have a physical reaction.
Yeah, yeah.
When did you bump into them for the first time?
I came to them by reading Baxendale's autobiography, which the wrong way around. That was about age 10 or 11. And
so you were interested in him as a creator of Beano?
Yeah, well, I'd say it's his autobiography. It's called A Very Funny Business, 40 Years of Comics by Leo Baxendale. And it's got pictures of Bass Street Kids on the cover. And I remember seeing this in the shop when I was 10, and I was into comics. You know, I liked them.
Mm.
And so I bought it, and I just read it over and over again. It was ridiculous. it was something about... He'd write about, well, his comics career, really. He started at the Beano in the early 1950s, created Bass Street Kids, Minnie the Minx, and Little Plum. And he was only there until the beginning of the 1960s. Then he left to do other comics.
He burned out, didn't he?
Well, wasn't he left the Beano to do a comic called Wham for Odham's Press. And that had characters like Grimly Fiendish.
Who oh God, I remember that vividly. I can't work out how I know about Grimly Fiendish.
Apart from
I didn't
the,
read
the Damned.
Yeah, but, I mean, but it was that's a face. I saw a picture of, I was looking up Baxendale's face, and I thought, I remember that face. It must have been reprinted in Monster
Files. I think it was reprinted in various places. And then he went on to draw for things like Buster, for Fleetway, the publishers, and he did things like Clever Dick, who was this schoolboy inventor, and Snooper, who was like a boy with a very long nose.
That was enough of an idea.
Yeah, it wasn't an idea he was that keen on, because it had been done before with, what's her name? I was going to say Arsehole Kate.
Arsehole Kate.
Someone at Viz did a Arsehole Kate, where she's this little girl going and pressing her eye up against people's ring pieces. But anyway, I shouldn't confuse the two, should I?
So you read about Willie the Kid in...
I read about... Because A Very Funny Business came out the same time as the Willie the Kid book 2, I think, 78.
Yeah.
And so I'd read about it, and then I wrote to Duckworth's, the publishers, to buy the Willie the Kid books directly, because I was an instant fan of Baxendale. So.
There was something, because Duckworth's published the Willie the Kid books, and the total joke... which we talked about when we were talking about the Python books recently, that every corner of every page has got a joke on it.
Yeah.
And I was convinced that Gerald Duckworth was such a brilliantly stupid name that it must have been a made-up character as well. I talked to Simon Kane, who we work with a lot, who does John Finnemore's programme and did Angstrom with us, and he was obsessed by Willie the Kid, and he similarly, like me, thought Gerald Duckworth's was a made-up joke name like Lord Gnome or something, because their address was the Old Piano Factory, Gloucester Road or something. That's such a Willie the Kid place for this to be published.
The Old Piano Factory, yeah.
like from Scooby-Doo, the Haunted Piano Factory. And recently I found out where it is. It's in London, and me and Simon keep saying we're going to go and make a pilgrimage there and just stand outside there.
I've always intended to do that.
So Willie the Kid is a natural extension of what Leo Baxendale was doing with the Bass Street Kids. It's a naughty kid kind of setup. But there's something about it that's not only completely sort of unfettered and free, but also just totally unhinged.
Mm.
It seems that he's got no rules. He can just fill the front of the book to the back of the book however he wants.
Yeah, you got the impression that he was amusing himself when he was doing the book. And that's a great thing when you're a kid, when you're about 10 or 11, to read that. Because it's not just that it's flattering that you're being treated as an adult, but it's more that he's sort of saying, this is what I find funny, and you can come along if you want, but I'm not too bothered if you can't, sort of thing, you know. But there's something very appealing about that.
But also the fact that you can sense that he himself is not going to let any part of the frame go unused, is he? So there's a sequence where, is it in the first book?
There's
what's great is as you flick through the books, you keep glimpsing things. I've just seen the biggest dopey in the world, which I think was the thing that made me unable to breathe. It's a huge wooden dopey from Snow White that kicks the children up a helter-skelter.
And out of the play park. So they have to pay to get in again. He's a cunning child.
In the strip, Woody the Kid, the great animal trainer, his next-door neighbours are... In one frame, they're a family of Daleks. Then in the next frame, it's senior members of the Nazi party. Then it turns into King Kong. And then you're looking through next door's front window to see a snowman outdoors. So he's even busting the rules of physics. The thing I liked about that was I thought, I can't work out whether he's just bored or whether he spotted that I've drawn this giant window. I'd better just fill it with something that amuses me. But the amount of pleasing himself that he's doing is so delightful.
Well, he said as well that he hated doing backgrounds. He'd happily just draw people on a white background. Mm. And everyone I know, all cartoonists I know, hate doing balloons, lettering and backgrounds. Mm. And you get the feeling that because he's got to fill the background with something, he just keeps himself entertained.
Yeah. One thing about the first Willy the Kid book, he had to do... very quickly. I mean, his plan was to spend a whole year producing a book, but the way it works out, by the time the contract was signed, he had 6 months to do the whole thing. He thought he'd make up for the hurriedness of the drawing by stuffing as many gags in as possible, which is, he wanted to give value for money, you see.
At the time, I read somewhere that children had powerful eyeballs, 16 times more powerful than adults. I had no idea whether that was true or not, but certainly they were powerful because they never missed anything. And I could put a tiny microscopic little extra gag in a corner and they would write in about it.
It's really generous. Someone was saying that when it came out, it had a big sticker on the front saying £1.
Mine still does.
Oh, beautiful.
Fantastic £1 values.
But you see that as a kid on the shelf at, I don't know, Martin's or Smith's or whatever, and you think, and it's next to the other kids' annuals, but it's not a kid's annual.
Mm.
You said it talks to you a bit like a grown-up, and it's clearly a grown-up doing it, because it's got sort of... It's a little bit sort of sexy and a bit naughty in places.
It's quite rude at times.
Yeah, it's got, like, corset adverts and jokes about bums and the word turd.
The mouse turd joke.
He's offered mustard on a hot dog and it's mouse turd.
Yeah, and he doesn't actually say the word turd, but I remember reading that and obviously... 11 years old, and there's a joke involving the word turd. I couldn't quite believe that's what the joke was. Even
I must have got this wrong.
So what the joke is it's smashing Sandra, isn't it? There's the girl from the fifth form.
Smashing Sandra.
Who
two
really
words
fancies.
That can only be from the 70s.
That's a really 70s name, isn't it?
It is, isn't it? Yeah. It's this girl that Willie fancies. He's got a dog holding a sausage, and on the sausage there's a mouse straining to move its bowels, and she's saying, "You stupid dog, I said I wanted mustard on the sausage." It's the rudest joke that I'd probably read at the time. There's ruder ones in the Willy the Kid books as well. There's some extremely rude
ones. Very naughty, and it's got the layout and the busyness of it, that it's just, there's a joke in every corner, and he's obviously, as you said, he's gone for value for money and density. So it takes ages to read each page. And it's the lovely cartoonist's sense of saying, I'm going to fill this with stuff because it's taken me ages to draw it. It should take you ages to read it. He used to do it with the Bash Street Kids. There'd be a big fight scene and it would take you ages to look for all the things all the different kids were doing in it. The chaos, the busyness, it's like a Bruegel or the Bayeux Tapestry or something. Everyone's up to something in different corners. And it's saying, please pause and take ages to read the work that took me hours to do.
Children, they have their own personal comic. It's their private property. They can read it as slowly as they like. They can go back to it after they've read it and pore over it. They can sit with their chin in their hands and really stare. They can find a little extra funny bit I've put in one corner, sort of gag away in the background. They can look at an expression on somebody's face. And because I don't really think of them as cartoon characters, I think of them as people, real little people, rather bizarre little gargoyle-type people, but real people nevertheless, who inhabit a world which I created and lives inside my brain. And I have to take them out and transplant them onto paper so they still live in that world on the paper. And I think the kids treat them like that.
It reminded me of doodling in the back of a school book. where you'd fill every corner of the back of your physics book because you were bored in the lesson. As a kid, I understood it had been done by a grown-up, but I wasn't 100% sure it hadn't been done by one of my classmates.
Again, it's that he's obviously enjoying himself doing it. When you're drawing as a kid, that's the only reason you're doing it. You're doing it for its own sake. You're not, you're not trying to produce something particular.
That's a very good point. That's a really good point, that, actually. The guiding impulse is to entertain yourself, isn't it?
Mm. It's the process of doing it is the point of it, really.
Yeah.
So if you're not having fun doing it, then why bother?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it also, if you're not having fun doing it, it might well show.
Yes.
Because that's the kind of thing that's quite hard to disguise. It's quite hard to sort of confect enthusiasm, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
There's a nice... He's playing with the background gags and filling the windows with different neighbours and things. But he has a joke at the expense of that joke, where he's drawn something with a house in it, and in the third frame he says, he writes on top of it, "I can't be bothered to draw this house anymore. I'm going to have it struck by lightning." And the next frame, a lightning bolt comes in, but it misses the house and kills the dog.
You can see, we were talking about the joy of the day-to-day and things, where you can see the production team behind the show. You can see them annoying each other, they don't like each other and things. And weirdly, this is, you can see the world beyond the drawing board. You can see him getting bored, going to get a cup of tea. It's all visible. The background isn't just the background of the drawings. The background is his house and his life. And he's sort of saying, I am a person. I'm not Mr. Beano artist. Leo Baxendale.
He depicts himself in there as well, doesn't he? He does that thing like in Duck Amuck, where you see the animator at the end of the thing, you know.
And you see him coming in with a rubber, rubbing out the house. It's the dog's bone he's using as a rubber.
Everything's visible, and he's letting you see how he's doing it. And I suppose, again, you pick a book up from W. Smith's about how comics are made when you're a kid. You want to know what these people are like. You want to know his life. You want to know about the man who draws this stuff. Because I remember as a kid growing up liking comics, the information about how they were made was kind of secretive. And if ever there was an article in a magazine about it, I'd cut it out. Or if ever there was a book, Dennis Gifford wrote a book about comics, I'd rush out to the library and get it out and read it cover to cover and learn it. And all those clues... names, credits, because they used to paint out the artist's names.
Yeah, I'm just going to say this because you guys know more about comics than I do. Do you know why how that tradition ever established itself, that people just went uncredited for decades and decades?
I'm not sure. It was a DC Thompson policy, I think. Presumably the other publishers as well. There were a few exceptions to the rule. Their most prized artists in the 40s and 50s were people like Dudley Watkins, and he was allowed to sign his name on his drawings, and that was a huge honour for him. I'm not sure of the reason.
Well, they used to paint them out. I remember hearing that Kevin O'Neill is the guy who did Nemesis the Warlock for 2000 AD and Martial Law, like really, really great British comic artist. His first job was working for Fleetway with a bottle of Tippex, painting out artist signatures so that all the art would look like it belonged to the publisher, and it would remove their claim on credit. And Leo Baxendale took DC Thompson to court to get the rights to his characters back, because they were doing Bash Street Kids lunchboxes and things, or still drawing the strips he'd created. And he said, "I want to own this." And he got legal aid and spent 7 years fighting them to get that credit back, because it was assumed if you're a British comics creator, you didn't own anything.
Which and you didn't, and I'm sure you still don't. I think they came to a mutually agreeable out-of-court settlement, didn't they, Baxendale?
It wasn't Thompson's. Anything as close as creators' rights or anything. I think he managed to get some money and then publish loads of political pamphlets using it.
That's what he did. That's what he did with all his money. He published these pamphlets during the 1960s as well, which were proving that the Vietnam War could not be won on purely strategic grounds. He didn't write them, somebody else wrote them, but that's where all his money went.
Wow. So
polemics.
He was basically publishing a version of the Pentagon Papers then, wasn't he?
It was. They had all sorts of big names. I think Noam Chomsky was a subscriber and people like this. But he was, I think he was organiser of Dundee CND in the early 60s, and that's when CND was different from what it became. It was a fairly radical organisation, I think, at first, wasn't it?
You get that feeling of there being a very sort of rebellious spirit behind it, but beyond just the sort of St Trinians-ness of Bath Street, and it's not just naughty kids. There's a refusal to listen to rules There's a proper, genuine anarchic spirit to all his stuff that, again, I think as a kid I looked at and went, oh God, you can break all these rules, like you felt when you heard Dawn of the Goons or something the first time and went, there's that real anti-establishment feel to it.
Mm. Yeah. He was quite critical of some things that went on in comics as well, that the whole idea of reward and punishment, where you'd get justly spanked at the end or rewarded with a big feed. And he didn't like either of those things very much. It was, but he preferred the kind of randomness of the universe, you know.
Like, yeah,
things would happen to you, and that's not nothing to do with whether you've been good or bad. That's just the way it goes. You know?
Yeah, there's sort of moral. There's no morality in them, and you look back at those at what passed for sort of morality in British comics, and it was there's a heaven and a hell in the last panel. That you're either given a big slippering or a massive slap up feed at Hotel de Poche with bangers and mash and a waiter with a bottle of pop on a salver.
That's right.
That's that. The justice is pretty sort of binary in comics.
Yeah.
And but it isn't. It wasn't in the Bash Street Kids. It certainly isn't in Willy.
Yeah,
the Kid, that's there's nothing right. like that.
And Little Plum as well, which was one of his favourite characters in the Beano.
And it was a Native American
Native
character.
American, yes.
Probably not called that at the time.
but that was the character that I think Baxendale liked the most. He said he always had a great affection for Little Plum, and that was because it was set against this landscape of huge 1,000-meter drops or whatever and canyons, and there were, you know, people get thrown off the cliff by a gust of wind. I don't know what you'd call it, but he kept on referring to sudden gusts of wind throughout his later political work as well. It was
random fate again, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. Yeah,
undeserved, blown off a canyon. This could happen to you.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I think what is interesting about Baxendale, because he's born in the 1930 and he's out of the Beano by the 60s and he's doing something different. He's already sort of transcended it, but he is the soul of British comics. Anyone who really loves British comics, he gets cited as the guy who changed it from being a little bit staid and a bit 30s into something far more rebellious and anarchic. And that spirit, then Alan Moore said it, that questioning anarchic spirit informed every British comics creator and then led to them going to America and selling comics back to America, saying, ask questions about this, do something different. But the world he comes from, that very sort of staid, rules of justice version of British comics, is the thing that Viz springs from in the first place. And you can see that straight line going through, that Viz is the next thing that comes along that says, what if those rules were applied to other things in life? And I can see a straight line through from him to Viz completely.
There's a lot of injustice in Viz scripts from the very beginning. I mean, if you look at Biffa Bacon, which was it's quite clearly based on an old dandy strip called Bully Beef and Chips, where you've got the standard bully beating up the little kid who comes triumphant in the end. But Biffa Bacon is my favourite Biffa Bacon strips are the ones where he just wants to be liked by his mum and dad. he's trying to better himself and he wants to be able to get on, and they lead him on a bit and then they just crush him.
that was a thing that happened with Piffa Bacon that I thought was brilliant, because at the beginning it was all about the unfairness towards Cedric Soft. Mm. That great one where he's standing by the old dump and he spots like a boxing glove and a spring and a pram and a thing. And instead of building a machine to hurt him out of those, he just hits him with a sign from the dump. The brutality of, ooh, that gives me an idea, readers. He just pelts his teeth out with a sign that says municipal dump.
Are the scripts for the strips in Viz all written sort of in committee, you and Thorpey and Graham?
Now Viz is run by Thorpey and Graham. I went back to being freelance quite a few years ago now. So I just write my own by myself.
Yeah.
But when it was, I mean, at one point in the office there was, six of us, seven of us or something like that on the editorial committee.
Mm.
And so that they would all be written by committee then, or by however many people happened to be in the room at the time. But Graham and Thorpey have always written together. They're a very tight writing team.
Mm.
And then for everybody else, it was, like I say, whoever happened to be around at the time. The rule would be that the person who was drawing the strip would be the one with a pencil and paper writing it down, and then everybody else chipping in. There came a point where Graham and Thorpey decided to reverse that for the two of them, and so it'd be the person who wasn't drawing it who would have the final. You know, they'd have the pen and paper. So that means if the script called for a combine harvester going down a flight of stairs, then that would get written in. Whereas if you were drawing it yourself, you'd say, I'm not putting bicycles in. I'm not.
Another strip set in the Arctic tundra with no background.
That's right.
So it's basically the two of them hitting each other with the sign from the municipal dump.
Exactly, yes. I think that's the reason why they decided to swap it around.
There are strips like Biffa Bacon, which are clearly meant to be recognised, or at least spring from directly from another strip that existed. And it's sort of staring at Bully Beef until you go, actually, what would be really funny is if the violence was turned up to 10.
Mm.
But what I liked about your strips in Viz was they were even more than based on characters. They were based on the feel and the texture of old comics. It would be the treatment and the shape and the line of Film Fun or the Beezer or the Topper applied to absolute nonsense.
Mm.
It seemed to be a far more of a... As Viz has gone on and got more sort of socially satirical, the more it got sort of Student Grant and Fat Slags and things, and Roger Melly became bigger parts of Viz, the bit that sort of seemed to survive as a direct reference to the comics of my childhood and of before my childhood seemed to be your strips, which seemed to sort of still be fighting that war against sort of Film Fun when everyone else had forgotten that was the fight.
Yeah, I'm not sure how many people understood the Film Fun references at all. Because Film Fun must have faded out in, what, the early 1960s, maybe?
So it's bothering.
One for the youngsters, you know.
But throwing in something like taking a modern celebrity, doing like The Adventures of Stephen Fry or Billy Connolly or even the Oswald Mosley one, which I thought was a great one because he was someone who might have been in Film Fun.
Yes, yeah, that was...
But then throwing those things together, is that something that you were keen to just continue, or is it just something that's just in you because you're a comics fan?
The Oswald Mosley one, I think, was the first one, and I was trying to draw in that style, and it was a fantastic style in pre-war comics. Roy Wilson was probably the best of those sort of artists, and it was a very bouncy sort of... The drawings were all full of life and very wholesome-looking. Mm. Leo Baxendale didn't rate Roy Wilson. He said it was too... they were too twee, I think he said, for him. But Roy Wilson was a fantastic artist. And there's something in the way they were written as well, in the language. They had a kind of musical wholesomeness about it. And people were talking this ridiculous way, like, diddle my boots and all this sort of stuff. People like Joey Brown, I think, there would be Film Fun strips about him and... What's his name? Jack Warner. Jack Mind My Bike Warner.
Mm.
So that's why I put... It was Oswald Mind My Bike Mosley. I think nobody would get that reference at all, but it didn't seem to matter too much.
So do you still draw inspiration directly from looking at old comics, or is it just something you've now got a mulch of in your brain?
It's probably more I've got a mulch of it. I tried so hard in that there with things like Oswald Mosley and a couple of other strips, and I tried really hard to get that style, and I think it's kind of it's stuck, and now I'm kind of stuck with it. So if I'm drawing someone walking along a street, they've got a kind of 1920s swag it because I can't get rid of it now, I think.
Television has become very powerful. It's been parallel to my career. I think nowadays very small children, 5, 6, 7, 8 certainly, who read my stuff, watch television late into the evening. They watch sophisticated comedy like Fawlty Towers and the Monty Python stuff. And over these years, I think young children's perceptions have become very sophisticated, and they want real red meat, not some bland pasteurised product, and I give them what I like, and they like it.
Did you ever meet Baxendale?
I didn't, no. I corresponded with him a bit.
Did you?
I wrote to him. I was going to write to him when I was a teenager, but I didn't quite have the guts. But I wrote to him in the early 90s just to say, you know, I sent him some of my Viz stuff and said, just to say what an influence he'd been, really. Because I don't think I'd be doing this if I hadn't got so keen on his autobiography when I was 10. I think that probably sent me down a certain path.
Did you hear back from him?
Yes, I got a friendly letter back. And then, well, later on, email came along. So I'd occasionally email and he'd write back. He was always very friendly and encouraging. I remember emailing him to say that Viz, the publishers were trying to persuade us to go monthly, because it used to be every 2 months, Viz. Mm. And there was a certain amount of holding back, but we were dithering about it. I remember mentioning this to Leo Baxendale, and he said, don't go monthly. He was very keen on the idea that you should have as much time to do your stuff as possible. He thought that publishers, by their nature, are going to try and get more work out of you than is good for you.
Yeah,
of course. And that you should hold back against that, you know, hold against that. So,
I mean, I guess if you were working for something like DC Thompson, that was pretty much a sweatshop, wasn't it?
Well, it's 52 weeks a year. I mean, the comics have come out every week, so there's no holidays, no time to kind of stock take or anything, your thoughts or anything. It was just... he writes a lot about that. It troubled him, I think, this thing of just conveyor belt churning things out. And that's why he left comics to do Willy the Kid, really. He wanted more control over his time, I think.
Because it takes ages. I was always stunned by that, going up to watch the Viz offices and watching Viz being put together. The amount of hard work that goes into every page and every frame, especially for a throwaway joke. Putting too much detail into something that was just not worth the effort.
Yeah.
And part of the joke was that they'd wasted their time. You have to have an amazing single-minded dedication to your craft to go through with how hard it is to draw a combine harvester going downstairs for no reason at all.
Yeah. Well,
Alex Collier told me that he got so bored with lettering his comic strips that he had his lettering turned into a font, so he just didn't have to bother sitting there doing all that, as well as all the drawing.
Yes, I've heard him say, I think that's a bit mad, isn't it? I mean, it's all right. I mean, all power to his elbow. Lettering doesn't take that long, does it?
Well, Charlie Brooker used to be a cartoonist, and he stopped doing it. I said, why? And he went, speech balloons, it takes forever.
Oh, well, okay.
Apparently it's a reason enough for Charlie to have turned into a showrunner of an American TV series. It drove him to Black Mirror.
I'm wrong then.
Maybe you just like that bit.
No, I don't like it. I mean, I might try and buy that font off Alex. It's a good idea.
But it's the new Comic Sans. All primary schools will have Alex Collier's font.
How long does it take you to get a page from blank page to ink?
Including thinking of it, just the drawing.
Execution.
4 days is what I'd like. That's comfortable. But 3 days is all right. I've done it in less. I've done it in 2 days. And I've probably done it in a day and a half. But those were terrible. Really, really bad. There's one that sticks in my mind, which was, I must have done it shortly after I moved up to Newcastle. Because I remember doing it in the office. It was somebody else's idea. It was a good idea. And it was called Diana Ross's Dog Shit Museum. And it was the idea just being that Diana Ross had a museum of dog shit. I think it's the fastest I've ever drawn anything. And I ruined it. I ruined that good idea. With a sloppy drawing, but I'd probably did that in about a day, I think. But four days is what I'd like, or longer if you got it.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Well, that tells you exactly. If you're doing a DC Thompson rate of producing a comic every week and you've got to write it and come up with those ideas and it takes 4 days for anyone decent to draw a page.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of frames in a Viz page. There's five decks. Five decks of, say, about 20 to 25 frames, whereas a Beano page is probably about 9 frames. There's less detail in them as well, because they're full colour.
Eventually, the parody of the thing is more detailed and ambitious than the thing it's parodying.
Yes, we kind of got left behind, really.
What of the sort of the classic British comics did you read growing up? What was the one that you had a subscription for or went to the newsagents to get?
We got the Beano every week. I think I learned to read on the Beano because I got an older brother and sister, and my dad used to put the Beano on his along with the newspaper, you know. So I was reading the Beano before I knew what the words meant. I can still remember going through the pictures and not bothering with the words quite yet because I wasn't ready for that.
Wow.
So I think that's... that's how I learned to read. But then me and my sister bought loads. We bought Whoopi and Wizard and Chips. And we'd write our names on them. Sister would put Pippa's comic. We only had the Beano delivered, but then the rest would be bought with pocket money. Dad paid for the Beano to be delivered, and then the rest was up to us. I was keen on Monster Fun. That was one that Baxendale did a thing in called the Bad Time Bedtime Books. That was probably before your time. It was like a pull-out mini comic.
I remember them. The strange thing about comics as well is comics last longer. You think they're ephemeral. But I remember getting to lots of comics from jumble sales and from going to holiday cottages. You go to a holiday cottage and there'd usually be a cupboard containing like Ludo, Snakes and Ladders with Bits Missing, and then a pile of comics that had accrued there over holidays. And they'd sometimes be like 10 years old. And I remember reading the Bad Time Bedtime Books, and I think it was in a cottage in Dorset that someone had left it there.
Oh, right.
They'd hang around.
Yeah.
Longer. They're supposed to be disposable, and weirdly people collect them and hoard them.
Or just leave them in the bottom of drawers to go yellow, and then you're
porn, isn't it?
Ripped up under a hedge.
When the child bought the Beano with its tuppence, and this was one of the things about the Beano as compared with books, was accessibility. A child could afford tuppence. The crucial thing was that it became the child's property. The individual copy became the child's property. It could come back to it again and again in the privacy of its own bedroom. And that's why it could spend the time going back again and again and looking, searching for little gags that had missed the first time and savouring the faces.
A lot of comedy just makes you feel sort of warm inside. And when you get something that actually just spasms you and you can't help yourself, a physical reaction is the best thing to get.
Mm.
And the number of people I've met who sort of said that, I don't know, a single Viz ad or a frame from something made them actually just incapable of stopping. It's an amazing thing.
I remember really losing my shit quite seriously when I first saw Our Teacher's a Wardrobe.
That came from an old story in a children's annual called Our Teacher's a Walrus. And it was a text story rather than a comic strip. So it's quite an obscure...
Well, actually, I mean, that's a good technique. That's the defocusing. You stare at something, go out of focus, think, did I really see that? And that becomes... And you don't need to know the source material for the juxtaposition or the absurdity to make you laugh. And actually, I suppose it's because you don't know where it came from that it gives you that reaction of vibrating bum-faced goats or Paul Daniels' jet ski journey to the centre of Elvis or whatever. You don't know why you're laughing.
Yeah, because we used to have all these annuals knocking around the office from the 1950s and 40s and so on. Somebody just saw this, Our Teacher's a Walrus. And I think there was a whole spate of them. Our Teacher's a Microbe, Our Teacher's a...
There was an Our Wardrobe's a Teacher.
Our Wardrobe's a Teacher.
Yeah. Was the other one. Someone hanging ties off someone in a mortarboard.
That's basically. Right, yeah.
It's often when you're talking to people who sort of want you to write comedy for a show or whatever, they sort of say, the question is, there's something in modern culture. Oh, there's vloggers, or there's a new album by, I'm trying to think of anyone modern. I can't. Bros.
Boomtown Rats.
Yeah, there's a new album by the Boomtown Rats. And they sort of say, well, in order for everyone to get the joke, it's got to be something that was in the news this week. Otherwise, no one's got a hope of laughing at it. And the actual truth of it is that when Harry Enfield does Mr. Chumley Warner, no one who's watching Harry Enfield was watching a Pathé newsreel that morning. But there's enough of the spirit of the thing in the parody for you to get the joke, even if it's not of your generation or not of your culture. And actually, sometimes a parody of something allows you to understand something that you didn't know about before. And I think there's something you could probably look at Viz and triangulate back to understand all of the history of British comics, even if you grew up in,
if you wanted to,
Saskatchewan, if you could be bothered.
The idea in the Viz office was always that we make ourselves laugh.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, before I went there, you know, when Chris was editor and that, when I was reading it before, I'd only met them a few times. Reading the comic then, I'd get the impression they were just trying to make each other laugh in the office. And I think that was the way it worked. You have to show a certain amount of contempt for your audience. you can't be thinking all the time about what readers want.
Well, actually, that's the reverse. I'd say that's really flattering to an audience.
Yeah.
Contempt for the audience would be second-guessing them and going...
No, that's right.
Yeah, obviously, on the surface, you're going, I don't care what they think. But oddly, secretly, what you're saying is that you're inviting people to join a gang where you're all equals. We're all making each other laugh, including the reader.
Yeah.
We're not handing you down jokes from on high that we don't find funny.
If you walk into a pub and people are having a conversation, you wouldn't want them all to stop and say, well, what all this came from is this, and explain everything to you, you know. You're free to sit there on the corner of the table and listen if you want.
They were all gormless in one way or another, but quite well-defined shades of gormless. I was creating an uncertain world. And the fact that people are puny beings, they're not superheroes. And it was how these exuberant beings coped with that. They overcame the puny bodies and the forces that were brought to bear against them and the structures of power, and they marmalised them.
Goes back to that thing where you get the impression that he's pleasing himself in what he's drawing, I think. I mean, he obviously likes drawing Daleks. Willy the Kid books are full of Daleks. And this was 1975, 1976, 1977. I don't know much about Doctor Who, but I imagine that Daleks were...
A prime Tom Baker Dalek.
Yeah.
The references in it. Some of them are... It's that weird thing in the 70s where some of the references are to things that clearly... I don't know why kids are watching Kojak.
Yeah.
Which is... Isn't it a hard-bitten French Connection-style cop show that was on at about 10? And yet it's full of references to Kojak.
It's almost like he has these comedy tics, like facial tics, and they keep being repeated all the way through. It's Kojak, and you get Clockwork Kojaks in battle with Clockwork Daleks. There's even a Clockwork Stavros somewhere. And it's just this little curly hair going along the street with a clockwork key sticking out the back, going whirr, as it moves along the street.
Most comedy practitioners do have those little tics, though, don't they? You know, are you aware of ones that you have? Because I know, for instance, Gilbert Ratchet is just a series of increasingly absurd machines that go wrong.
That hurt testicles.
Yeah. Vickers and testicles, yeah.
Vickers and testicles.
That became a tick for a while.
Well, that's the title of your autobiography, sorted.
More songs about Vickers and testicles.
I like drawing Vickers, and I like drawing the same Vicar, really. And I like having them hoofed in the testicles. I mean, bad things. I don't know why it is. It's just... I think I must have drawn it once and thought, that feels nice.
What was the first strip you did for Viz?
It was Vlad the Impaler and his cat Samson. It was just a little half-page strip. That was in 1986. I sent them that. And that was the first one I sent to them, really.
Wow.
Had you ever had anything published by anyone before? Or was this the first
book you'd published? No, but the first stuff I published was from Oink, which was the kids' comic that came out in sort of mid-80s, was it? Lasted until the late 80s. Charlie Brooker worked for Oink as well. But I was doing a bit of stuff for them some people have used to call it a junior Viz, which was a bit unfair on Oink, really, because they were coming from a different direction to Viz. But they wanted to do a funny children's comic, and the editors were... They wrote for things like Buster. I think they admired Leo Baxendale as well. That sort of spirit of, we should be doing stuff that's funny rather than just going,
you want to
through,
get a laugh.
Going through the motions. And that was some brilliant stuff in Oink. It was a good comic. So, no, I'd done a bit of work for them and then started sending bits to Viz. And I did a little bit of work for a nursery comic, which didn't last very long.
A nursery comic?
Yeah, it was for people too young for the Beano and Dandy. And wow. It was called Nipper, I think. It was an IPC comic.
But once you worked for Viz, did you end up exclusively working for Viz? Was it that enough to satisfy you creatively?
Yeah, well, I started when I'd finished my A-levels and I had a year off. And I was trying to get cartoon work during that time. And then I went to college. And so I did bits of stuff for Viz and Oink while I was at college. Then when I finished college, I got a letter off Chris Donald saying, now you've finished fucking about wasting your time and taxpayers' money. Would you like to work for us on a regular basis? So mostly it's just been Viz ever since, really. Then in 1996, I moved up to Newcastle and kind of joined the staff. And so then it was very much just Viz.
Mm. In that period where you were in there, and obviously this is Viz had an office. During that period, I mean, I remember thinking that was about as good as Viz had ever been, when it had that density of voices in it and you could hear everyone was working together.
Mm.
And I was looking back at stuff and thinking that must have been quite a blast.
Yes, yeah, it was. When I first went, I don't think I spoke for the first 2 years because it was, these people obviously knew each other very well. I didn't want to interrupt. I do remember...
You're waiting for a gap.
I do remember laughing a lot. Chris kind of got sick of it, Chris Donald, the editor, so he left. And Simon Donald and Alex Collier both fancied doing something a bit different as well, so they left some years after that. So it was kind of whittled down. But yeah. Graham and Thorpey were always the spine of the comic, I think, in many ways. I mean, they wrote a lot of the kind of main stuff, the core characters. And
that's an interesting dynamic there, is that if you wrote out a list of Viz characters, then the core of them would probably belong to Thorpey or Graham. It's the Fat Slags and it's that stuff. What's strange is that the characters that orbit round it, the things that sometimes I think give Viz its flavour, if it was just these big Rabelaisian characters, it wouldn't be Viz. The joy of it, I think, was opening up and not knowing what your strip was going to be. Then suddenly bringing other voices like Drunken Bakers and things like that. Mm. That's the stuff that makes it, I think, really exciting. There are plenty of comics that had six great characters in them.
Were you in the room when Food and Drunk was written?
Yes, I was.
See, now that, when people talk about if you could travel through time to any point in history, would it be the fall of Rome? Mine would be to be just standing near the room when Food and Drunk, which we reckon is the greatest piece of comic prose in English. It's from about 2000, 2001.
Yeah, it was in the, we had the big office in the centre of Newcastle. Mm. So I do remember that afternoon. I think everyone was chipping into that.
It's, you get the feeling of a room full of ideas of people trying to top each other, and it's a column written ostensibly by Jilly Goulden, but instead of reviewing wine, she's reviewing her hangover. I don't think I've ever read anything better in my life.
There's I'm thinking about, you can never quite remember which bits are written by who, and it doesn't really matter anyway. But there's something about scrambled eggs.
that's the bit my eyes have just lighted on.
I remember that coming out of Thorpey's mouth.
I think it puts P.G. Wodehouse in the shade as a piece of sustained comic writing.
I know the section. I became aware of a strange feeling in my stomach. It was like Marlon Brando wearing a jumper soaked in seawater, trying to kickstart a diesel Harley Davidson fat boy in 2 feet of porridge. I was getting hippopotamus's tongue licking canal water off my kidneys, mixed with the Keystone Cops made out of omelette being chased out of my arse by a jelly tube train full of lead bricks.
It's poetry. It's absolute poetry.
There's a little bit later on, which isn't a funny bit, but it's true, because it's about a panic attack And it's to do with a great flash of light behind one eye. And that was based on a weekend in Beaumaris when I lived there. And my dog had died, and I went out drinking for a weekend. And I was quite pleased that made it in, because it's the, you know, that really happened.
That feeling of people are trying to beat each other at making each other laugh. That feeling of sort of barely contained hysteria.
Mm.
When you read something that's been written in those conditions, and the Leo Baxendale thing, I imagine, is similar. He's made himself laugh.
Mm.
For some reason, it's packed down into the page, and you can detect it. You can detect the shadow of hysteria on the writing.
Yes, yes.
I mean, we're doing it when we're naming strips that we liked. Just the first statement of the title is enough to conjure up those giggles from the first time they were made up, and that's just magical.
Yeah, sometimes there's a nice sense in your stuff that whatever provoked the initial idea is now a very, very long way behind where the idea is. So there's an Esther Ranson's Hearts of Gold thing, isn't there, that you did, which is obviously because she had a programme called Hearts of Gold on TV at the time. But that's not what you're doing. What you're doing is you're getting her flying around the world in a giant jet-powered golden heart with Cyril Fletcher.
Yes, that's right. And it wasn't just a heart shape. It was a genuine heart with ventricles.
Yeah.
I think one of the ventricles was the sort of control room of the heart. So it's quite nice to do things where it's quite obvious where the ideas come from. You know, it's obviously not particularly inspired, but it's you're just trying to do it in a slightly unexpected way, I suppose.
Well, I suppose it's quite that's kind of the flip of our teacher's a wardrobe, isn't it? If you're saying it's Esther Ranson, it's Hearts of Gold.
Mm.
It's a bit like saying it's Anton Deck and it's Saturday Night Takeaway. But if I took that as the starting point and called it Anton Deck Saturday Night Takeaway, but then took the idea a long way away from that and yet kept that title, the similar kind of thing to the teacher and the wardrobe, isn't it? Because it's basically going, I'm going to show you where this idea came from, but this idea is nothing like that.
Yeah.
Whereas our teachers of wardrobe is going, this is a fucking weird idea and you won't know where we got it from.
Yeah.
You know, even though the clue's there, if you know the reference.
Yeah.
Either disguise your working or show your working, both of which are funny, because the arrogance is thinking that people can't see what you've done.
That hadn't occurred to me before, but that's quite right.
There's a lovely one of those, which is a sort of standard strip ending, which is where the prize has been stated in frame two, and then in the last frame, the prize turns up, and it's not that sort of a thing. And that never isn't funny.
Good. I'll do another one. I think the first one of those was he was wanting to go to a fireworks display, and as it turns out, the fireworks display is just a bloke pointing to an electric two-bar fire, saying, "As you can see, this fire works perfectly well." And that was the disappointment of the end.
Again, it's just all the work that's gone into it for that wasted beat.
For that feeble ending.
There's a nice time are quite funny, aren't they? Actually,
God.
They're very.
Maybe that's the central joke with how long it takes to draw comics. Anyway, is that what you're secretly saying is we're here for a limited time on Earth, and I wasted 4 days on a joke about a firework. Are you better than me or any of us? There's one of those in Willy the Kid where the professor promises him he'll be free. Leo Baxendale goes, if you get to the end of the game, you'll be free, and he plays a whole elaborate game. At the end of it, a spotty dick is poured out of a cornflakes packet. Right. That's what you meant. It's that sort of you'll be free.
Free with Weetabix or something. Yes, that's right.
Spotty Dick's amazing.
Spotty Dick
might be the actual high achievement of the Will of the Kid books, where Mr. Toebone gets crushed by an enormous mincing machine. And he's being carried away on a stretcher as a pile of mints. And the boss says, "Mr. Toebone is very poorly.
We'll have to be taken to hospital."
What's great about that is what it comes after as well, because it comes after, look, this is how we make school dinners. They put a cow in a huge thing and then just mince it, and all the mince falls down into a pit and gets taken away. And then Mr. Toebone stands there and says, "Now I'm going to show you how to oil the machine." Spotty Dick knocks the lever with his nose, and Mr. Toebone gets turned into mince. And at that point, you think, OK, he's going to get added to the school dinners, isn't he? But no, he doesn't. Someone shovels all the mince up and carries it away on a stretcher because he's feeling poorly. It's such a lovely extra confounding.
It is, yeah. Mr. Toebone is drawn in the style of Don Martin.
From Mad?
From Mad Comics. And I think Leo Baxendale was in writing letters to Don Martin at the time. That kind of humour is very Don Martin humour, where people are turned into mints.
Well, there's a network of fandom that happens that I think is probably one of the reasons that we're talking about Leo Baxendale now, is that he was a huge fan of other people and references them in his work, and then he passes on to Nick Park and to you and to everyone else. There's a great, I think, is it Will and the Kid Book 2 at the back? There's a monster drawing competition, and one of the winners is Miles Hunt from Birmingham. And I'm thinking that must be Miles Hunt from the Wonder Stuff. Not that Miles Hunt went on to do comics, but it's passing on a continuation of, if you like this, join the club.
Leo Baxendale's work is full of Giles characters. Not the main Giles characters, but just someone in the background, a tobacconist or something like that. And you can see that they're not just done vaguely in the style of, he's actually copied the characters exactly. And he was a huge Giles fan. And that's a good thing, because, again, that's another thing that you do as a kid. When you're drawing for the sake of drawing, you see a Giles cartoon or whatever, and you think, I want to draw that. And so that's what you do. You draw that. You draw what's in front of you, and you copy it.
So he's doing what you're doing. There's a the doodlingness of it. He's...
Yeah, just for the satisfaction of being able to draw like that.
What he's telling you through the books, and especially through Willy the Kid, is because he's not doing this for DC Thompson anymore. He's not doing it for a living. He's doing it because he wants to draw and he can't stop drawing. And it's almost like a message in the bottle said, if you're like this, if you suffer from this illness as well, that you can't stop drawing, no one's going to stop you.
Yeah.
I suppose it's quite a liberating thing to be told as a kid.
Absolutely. Yes, but that, especially at that age, because that's what you're doing anyway. And that there's a grown-up doing it for...
That's a sort of allowable thing, though, isn't it? Because if you become a jobbing cartoonist, you may well get given a character to draw. So you've got to be able to imitate that style. You've got to know how heavy the line is and that kind of thing.
But being able to draw like other people, copying other people, is the best way to learn how to draw stuff, I would imagine.
Yeah.
And it's also it's satisfying in itself as well. Because even though you'll probably never quite get what they've, what the original's like. I sort of tried and failed to do it in a lot of those strips, like the Oswald Mosley, and I couldn't get the bounce or anything. I don't suppose that's something you can copy. You can't copy the liveliness of a drawing, but it seemed worthwhile having a go at it anyway.
And that's a pretty standard thing in so much art and creating stuff, is you're aiming at something and missing. By aiming and missing, you create something of your own.
Yeah.
And there's something no one else could draw like you, and no one else can really draw like Leo Baxendale, but by aiming at it and missing, you find your own style.
Yeah, and not to worry too much when you do miss as well. It doesn't matter all that much.
No one cares.
The one thing Leo Baxendale said was that he didn't think style was particularly important, because you get some... I mean, if you look at a Garfield cartoon, say... But you can see style is very important. They're going for a brand there, aren't they?
Yeah.
It's instantly recognisable. Whereas for Leo Baxendale, if you look at his drawings from the very early 1950s to the end of the 50s, and he went through so many changes, and he wasn't trying to have a recognisable style that he could monetize. He was just trying to make a good job of the page in front of him.
Yeah.
And so you could see it gradually changing. And it settled into a more solid style by the mid-60s, but you got the impression he never really stopped trying out other things as well.
Pleasing himself.
Yeah,
you can see he's pleasing himself. He's not doing an efficient, crisp, workmanlike job. He's trying stuff. There's two frames in Willy the Kid where he's claiming it's being drawn by a drawing robot.
Yeah.
And one of the Willy the Kids doesn't look like Willy the Kids. And there's a little note saying, you've made me look like a turnip. And then the next frame, he looks more like Willy the Kid, and a little caption saying, that's more like it.
Yeah.
And he's got it wrong. And then he's gone, I'm not going to rub that out or redraw. I'm going to make a joke out of the fact that one of these Willy... He does look like a turnip. He's right. Thank you so much for coming and bringing Willy the Kid, because I didn't think anyone was going to bring that. And it's the best thing. But thank you for your time.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Thanks, Davey.
Lovely. Cheers.